welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 269 of the podcast, and it is the 14th of May, 2016, as I record this. So today I have an interview with Lisa Congdon, who is a visual artist, illustrator, and author of Art Inc., which is all about making a living from visual art. And I'm really interested in Lisa because she kind of epitomizes the multiple streams of income from visual art, which is something I'm not gifted with or that I haven't learned over time, although my dad is a visual artist. So I think it's always important for us to be learning from people in tangential industries. And we talk about the parallels in the creative process because Lisa's also an author and how long it takes to make a living from your art. So I'm really looking forward to that interview. But first, a little update, given that I am now back from Spain. So we spent some time in Malaga and Granada, and also did a week's walking in the Alpujarras region south of the Sierra Nevada, so really the very south of Spain. And on one day walking, we could actually see the coast of Morocco over the Straits of Gibraltar, so that was quite cool. And the consecutive days walking in the mountains was part of my training for the 100-kilometer race to the stones, which I'm doing in July. And so because I don't normally do multi-day walking, you know, I might go for a long walk on one day, but I haven't done then sort of get up the next morning feeling kind of stiff and with blisters and then walking again. So the most walking was 5 days consecutive. And by the fifth day, I was definitely over it. But what it's proved to me is that I can walk when I'm tired, in pain, and with blisters. So these are the things that will give us confidence. And just as a parallel to the creative life, you know, people say, how do you become more confident in your writing? And I think the only way is to actually do it. So the same with anything, your confidence only improves when you try things and you manage it, even if it's not perfect. So it was a good holiday, and I will, I have put my pictures on Flickr and I'll link to those in the show notes. So I did a lot of reading and thinking on holiday, but not much writing. I did a bit in my journal, but the aim was definitely not to do any writing, was to think and read. But there are also, we also saw quite a lot of cultural things. As ever, I'm obsessed with religious iconography and architecture. So we went to quite a few cathedrals, monastery, and some of the pictures you'll see, there are some very odd, I say odd. I think it's odd that some Catholic churches have very graphic portrayals of martyrdom, and some of those pictures are in the Flickr album, and will definitely be coming out in some of my books. But I did want to mention a couple of things. First of all, we went to the Picasso Museum in Malaga, which is a very small museum. Picasso was from Malaga, but once he left, he basically never went back. But they have some of his work, some of his very early work from the late 1890s all the way through to work in the 1970s. So he died at 91 and basically created since he was a child. And what I love about this museum and also the visual art world in general is that they are very good at recognizing an artist's development, and they talk about a body of work, but they also categorize artists like Picasso into phases of development and phases of creativity, and they actually allow for this development and this change. You know, some of his earlier work looks like just normal painting. And then, of course, you really get his later work, which you would all recognize. So
What is different in the literary world is it seems totally obsessed with debut authors making huge deals with their first books. And then the publishing industry is like, oh, well, this works, so you have to write the same book over and over again. This is something we don't have to do as indies. And this is very important. What we don't want, we want to model the best practices of traditional publishing, which is, you know, good editing, cover design, this type of thing. But what we don't want to do is to be pushed into the same type of behavior, which is create the same book over and over again. Now, I like writing a series, but I have several and I'm writing different things. And I think that's very important. The other thing is that looking at Picasso's early work, of course, some of it's really crap. And also the rumours are, well, the estimates of his work are between 50 and 100,000 pieces, of which only a few would be known as masterpieces. But equally, some of his little sketches that he would dash off sell for a lot of money. And he often gave those to lovers. He was a prolific lover as well as a prolific creator. But what's interesting, I think, is the visual art world values these dashed off pieces as much as they value, I mean, not financially value, but they're framed in the gallery next to works which are, you know, highly developed pieces from his later life. So what I want to sort of bring from this is, of course, your early work's going to be crap. Of course, your first book's not going to be brilliant. Of course, you develop over time. Of course, you're going to be a better writer after 10 years, you know, after, what, 70 years, I guess. No, even more. He died at 91 and his first work, I think, was around the age of 15 or something. So you can create for your whole life, create this body of work. Don't obsess about, like, right now. The other thing is about his being prolific with those huge estimates of his creativity. And of course, he famously destroyed quite a lot of them that he was unhappy with. Only a few of those would be well known, in the same way that someone like Isaac Asimov, who I think wrote around 400 books, is only known for a couple of them. So this is important. You won't create a masterpiece without a lot of practice, and it's very unlikely that your masterpiece will be the first thing you do. So very important to consider that. And finally, two more things on Picasso, because I'm going to blog about this because I think he's a very good role model in some ways, not in his personal life. But when he died, he was worth about $500 million. So you can be a very wealthy creative. And of course, the early stories, the starving artist story, he did burn some of his early paintings for to keep warm. By the time he died, his estate was worth, you know, $500 million. And, you know, people seem to talk about and praise the starving crazy artists like Van Gogh, but potentially Picasso might be a better role model as someone who was prolific, created masterpieces and, you know, the equivalent of literary works, as well as making a lot of money. So that's cool. But one of the bad things he did, and like Prince, as we've seen recently, Picasso died without a will. Whereas Prince has only a few relatives, Picasso had multiple ex-wives, mistresses and children, and a very complicated personal life, which meant his estate was complicated. So another reminder to sort out your literary estate as time ticks by, because you never know. And in fact, I've been looking into James Michener. If you like epics, James Michener wrote The Source, which is a book I read when I was about 15. And then I went off to Israel off the back of reading that book. And Israel appears in most of my books. It's a place I love to go. It's a complicated place for sure, and has a lot of problems, but is one of these sort of amazing places that means a lot to me. So I read James Michener's The Source. I wanted to read it again. I want to read it again, but it's not available in ebook format. And in fact, many of his books, many of his 40 epics, are not available in ebook format, certainly in the UK. So I've started to trace his estate, and I've actually written them a letter and said, I would really like this book to be in ebook format. And if you need help, I could do that for you. So I'm starting to think about these types of books that, you know, really last. And of course, we all want our own books to do that in the same way that Picasso and Prince, their creative legacy lives on. So you can tell this might be a slightly longer introduction today, but a number of you have said you enjoy the introductions. And the magic of podcasting is you can always fast forward if you don't want to listen. So the next thing I wanted to talk about was the actual physicality of the Alpujarras region where we walked, which is sort of mountainous valleys irrigated by these acequias, water channels that were built by the Moors sort of 800 years ago and still irrigate the valleys when they're cleared out properly. And pretty amazing design, really. But I'm a city person. I love the city, but I live a long way from a type of lifestyle that is dependent on the land. And I think that this is an important lesson for creatives as well, is that the whole place that where we walked had this real sense of the seasons and the land and the harvest. And I wasn't there in the winter. We were there just as things were starting to flower and bloom and the insects were coming out and the animals were being born and things. But the guide talked about how the winter works and how the harvest works and how dependent people are on the land and how important it is to replenish the soil and what to plant to make the soil rich again. And it reminded me of, again, the seasonality of our lives and also our creative lives, because we can't, if you think of yourself as that land, you can't be producing the whole time. You need to allow for rest and for your mind to lie fallow so you can enrich the soil of your mind, and then you have that intense period of creation, the hard work when you sow and then you plow and then you reap and then you harvest and all that. That's only a certain part of the year. And then in the winter, people will rest, conserve energy, save up the stuff from the summer and the autumn. And I was thinking, you know, this actually reflects my own cycles a lot more. I'm not someone who writes for publication every day. I often write every day something, but that might be something in my journal, it might be blog posts, obviously we all do emails. But in terms of creation, I think for me, this cyclical periodic thing works better in that earlier this year, so January, I pretty much wrote the first draft of Destroyer of Worlds. And then February, I edited it and, you know, obviously then went into a whole load of other stuff. But I feel like when you write a novel that quickly, or a book, a nonfiction book or anything that quickly, and you kind of empty yourself, you need time to replenish. So I feel like after, the other thing is for me, the travel that replenishes me is this type of travel, not Austin when I went and spoke at Smart Artist, which was brilliant. And also speaking at London Book Fair, brilliant. But those types of travel tire me out. Whereas I'm replenished creatively by travel as I've just done, which is more sort of going and seeing cultural things and walking. And by the end, returning yesterday, I think I was brimming with ideas and I have a massive list of things I want to do. I've read a whole load of books on ancient Babylon and the end of days, and I've got a short story that's coming, and I've also been thinking about the mindset book, which you'll be, many of you have emailed me to encourage me to finish this book. Thank you for that. And I actually have the next 3 weeks booked out to finish this, get it to my editor by the end of May. So that will definitely be coming in probably July. I'm going to do an audio version at the same time, so that will be fun. Okay, so that's an update and some lessons learned from the holiday time. A few things in publishing that I wanted to mention that I've noticed have happened in the last few weeks. I didn't actually completely unplug, which I was fine with. I actually spent probably 20 minutes every day doing the usual things I do, things like Twitter and checking Facebook and email. So as somebody, you know, I just didn't want to unplug completely, actually. I wanted to not come back to a whole backlog. That's the one of the problems with running your own business, I guess, is that no, actually, that's not true. If you take 2 weeks off any job, you come back, you're going to have a backlog. So I'm happy to say I've come back and kind of kept on top of most things. So that's good. But anyway, so I've been keeping up with the news. A few things that I've noticed that I think are very interesting. One, Wattpad Studios launched off the back of the wildly popular Wattpad story site. And if you write YA or you're a younger author, That is an amazing community with a lot of opportunities. They are kind of curating and helping people who are doing well. And now they have this Wattpad Studios, which is moving into film. So the other thing, it was Wattpad is named one of the safest spaces for LGBTQ youth to hang online. Now, you know, that's fantastic that we're hearing the voices on Wattpad that we may not hear in mainstream writing. So fantastic. Go Wattpad. And Wattpad is spelled W-A-T-T-P-A-D. If you are interested in having a look, wattpad.com. Amazon Video Direct also launched, which I also find very interesting because they have a pot of money like KDP Select and also a share in other revenue like Amazon Prime and advertising and other things. So potentially, if you fast forward 5 years, this could be, you know, could disrupt the film space in the way that KDP has done for books. And of course, with equipment getting cheaper, with people able to make things much more cheaply and, you know, people doing short films, other video, this, you know, firstly will aim to go up against YouTube for premium user generated content, but potentially could also get films by more independent people in front of an audience like me. I'm an Amazon Prime and I watch Amazon Video already. So I'm quite looking forward to seeing what comes out of Amazon Video Direct. Of course, the rise and rise of more content creation means that I believe we will also see the rise of better discoverability engines and better curation based off the media themselves. And I've talked before in a couple of interviews on future stuff about how it's crazy that we have to come up with categories and keywords and book descriptions when the book itself is metadata. And looking forward to the day when AI or some kind of augmented and applied intelligence is able to serve and curate and recommend books based on the emotional resonance that people get. So fiction is very, very hard to work with, especially if you're cross-genre like my books are, like many of our books are. And as per what I said earlier, I think it's important that indies do work cross-genre and do things that traditional publishing might just not know how to sell. I think these books will find a place and will be much more easily discovered in the next few years as these discovery engines appear. And off the back of that, the self-publishing podcast guys got very excited this week in episode 209 about being involved in an applied intelligence engine for books. So that's an interesting interview with Michael Anderley. And when I spoke at the Smarter Artist Summit in Austin, I actually talked about Interlogo, Intellogo, Interlogo, who are doing a similar thing with sort of machine learning, looking at how you can map your story. So that's interesting. Also Trajectory, who are mainly working with traditional publishing. But basically, I know of now that's three companies who are working on this type of applied intelligence discovery engine based on the book itself. So I think that we will see these things start to happen in the next couple of years. And so never fear, there will always be more and more content created as people express themselves, and we want to celebrate that and encourage that. And this will be matched by a better discovery engine. The human curator role, I think, will always be around, the trusted source of information. And I hope that I'm that for you in many ways. And I normally share my own curated stuff on Twitter. Okay, just a couple more things before we get into the interview. Kobo launched in Turkey, so international focus, Turkey being a country of around 70 million people with around 12 million English speakers. So potentially a good new market. Also interesting that that Kobo is moving into areas where Amazon isn't. So I think this is what you have to look at. If you envision the world map, obviously we've got some big markets that are dominated by Amazon, but then you're getting loads and loads of little dots around the world in various countries where the color would be iBooks or Kobo as dominant platforms or other things. So it'd be quite interesting to see a map of that at some point. But we live in this global economy, so it's very important for us to consider these other potential markets. And finally, IPR license, which is a service where you can upload your books and try and get matched with publishers looking for foreign rights deals. So potentially a new way to sell international rights without an agent. Now, that's been around for a while, but the news a few weeks ago is that Frankfurt Book Fair has become a majority shareholder in IPR license, Frankfurt Book Fair being the major rights fair, foreign rights fair of the publishing industry. So I'm very interested in that because it means that IPR license will potentially become a lot more valuable. And I've looked at it before, decided it wasn't worth doing, but I now am interested in doing that again. Okay, so I have tons of emails and tweets from you all. Thanks so much for sending them. I love to hear from you. But here is just a selection. Seamus Anthony says, just firing up the latest episode after having finally pushed the publish button at Kindle for the first time. Exciting. That's fantastic, Seamus. And one of my goals when I first started the blog and the podcast was to, get more books out into the world for other people. So I'll add you to my list. I wanted to kind of release a million books over time. So not just obviously not myself. But through sharing how to do it and helping people release their creativity. So that's very cool. Michael Boncher says, devouring the back catalogue between 2 and 4 episodes per night while working night shift at a truck stop in Green Bay, Wisconsin. I love this, that Michael is listening to between 2 and 4 episodes a night is kind of crazy. But that way he'll probably get through the whole backlist in like 100 nights. And I think this is the magic of audio because, I've been doing this since 2009 and I know some of you have been listening that long and thank you for being there and supporting. But it's very cool that people can discover the podcast at any point and then go back and listen to a lot of stuff which is still relevant. I mean, anything on creativity will always be relevant and also kind of get a catalogue of what's changed over the years. Perry says, love the podcast. I listen while walking or driving, and it's the only podcast where I need to remember to check the transcript for ideas. Thank you, Perry. The tip on Cinnamon Teal Publishing sparked a new sales channel idea, and that was from the publishing in India. Yes, so just a reminder that you can always check the show notes where there is a transcript of the interview and all the links from the introduction. Jenny says, I've watched your interviews on YouTube for months, but just got an iPad and subscribed to the podcast via iTunes. I never knew what I was missing. Yes, so this introduction, you only get on the iTunes feed. YouTube only has the actual interviews. But if you want to, I will be doing some more videos though. Now I've got my husband on board. He's going to be doing some filming. So I am going to be doing some more separate content for YouTube. But Jenny said she enjoys the updates before the interview and loves hearing about what it takes for an introvert to succeed in the writing business. Thanks, Jenny. Richard E. Todd listening while flying to San Francisco for an anti-money laundering conference, which I thought was very sort of apt given the Fonseca thing that's been happening with all the sort of offshore money, which has been all over the news. Alicia, now I'm probably going to get this wrong, Alicia Klapiki. Yeah, nice name. I listen to the podcast as I run on the Natchez Trace wagon trail turned nature reserve, which sounds very cool. Lisa M. Lilly, listening while drinking appropriately labelled wine, sent me a picture of a bottle of fiction wine, as the label says fiction, which I hope it wasn't fictional wine. That would be disappointing. Just a couple more. Russell Phillips, listening to the show while mapping for OpenStreetMap, sent me a picture of a handheld GPS, which is the first time I've seen one of those. Matthew Brough, listening to the podcast on a walk in Canada's largest urban nature park and has sent me a lovely picture. And Assiniboine, I think it is, Assiniboine Forest. Amy Hopkins, I've clearly been missing the podcast. I've used super 4 times this morning already. Thank you. I'm glad to be impacting everybody's language as well as your fitness. Okay, so there were lots more, but we've already gone on a little bit long. But thank you as ever for your emails, comments and tweets about listening to the show. And please do continue to send them because I love the interaction. Okay, so this podcast episode is sponsored by 99 Designs, and you can get a power pack upgrade worth $99, which gives your project more chance of getting noticed by going to 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A. So on 99 Designs, you can get all kinds of designs for your author business, including book covers, what a surprise, merchandising, branding and business cards, illustrations, artwork and much more. So one idea today would be to get a brand for your publishing company if that's something you want to do, or your imprint, a logo. You could get business cards for all those conferences you go to, because as ever, I'm always shocked when I go to conferences and people come and talk to me and then I say, oh, have you got a card? And they say, no. So definitely get business cards. So how does 99 Designs work? You do your design brief. So if it's a book cover, for example, what goes on the front, the title, subtitle, author name. If it's print, what goes on the back and the spine as well. Think about the genre, the feelings, think about cover ideas and use examples from your genre. So you can upload files if you want to take screen prints of things. I always think the more information, the better up front. Because that will help you get good designs. Once you get a whole load of designs, you give feedback. People do a second round of designs based on your comments. You can do a poll to your social media or your email list. And then once you pick the winner, you get the files and you're done. And it is guaranteed. If you don't like it, you don't pay. Although I have a book cover designer, I have used 99 Designs for 2 custom illustrations, The Key to the Gates of Hell, which features on the cover and the interior of the book of the same name, and also the map at the front of dark fantasy thriller Risen Gods. So there is 100% money back guarantee, and you can get a power pack upgrade worth $99, which gives your project more chance of getting noticed by going to 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon, and I really, really appreciate the Patreon support. It means a lot to me, and it's kind of physical evidence that you want the show to continue. Thanks especially to the bumper crop of new patrons, which is basically 3 weeks worth of new patrons. Tim Moore, Jamie Arpin Ricky, J.M. Taylor, Jennifer Leo, Robert Scott Norton, Karen Judge, Alison Ingleby, Nick Warren, Alex Turnbull, Carlin Hansen, Jenny Wiltz, Ida Sophie Tankula Plum, which is just a brilliant name, and Louise Waghorn. Thank you to all of you and to everyone supporting on Patreon. It is super duper. I really love it. And on Patreon, you can support me with even just $1 a show, or more than $1 a show if you like, to a maximum of 2 shows a month, less than a coffee a month. And now you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio if you can't get enough of my voice. So I'll be recording that show in the next week. So if you're a patron, even, you will be getting a message about that. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Whew, okay, that was a bit of a long intro, but I hope you enjoyed that update. And now we will get into the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Lisa Congdon. Hi Lisa.
Hello.
Great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Lisa is a fine artist, illustrator, and creative entrepreneur. She's also the author of a number of books, including Art Inc., The Essential Guide for Building Your Career as an Artist. So, Lisa, you came later to art. How did you make that move from a real job as a project manager to becoming a full-time artist?
Well, it took many years, but it happened at least initially sort of on accident. When I was about 31 years old, I decided to take a painting class just for fun. I had a full-time job, as you mentioned, working in education nonprofit here in the United States, and I felt the urge to do something creative. So I took this painting class, and then I fell in love with painting. I was not very good at it, but this one class sort of changed my perspective about, spending time making things. And so I started taking more classes, in particular from this particular teacher who I took that class from, and then started taking some drawing classes, and I set up a little studio in my kitchen table, but I had no aspirations to become a professional artist. This was purely for enjoyment, which is, I think, always how one should start the creative process. But eventually, I started sharing my work on the internet. Mm. And it was around the time that the internet was becoming a place where artists and writers and people who were experimenting in creative processes were sharing their work for the first time with people who they didn't know. Previous to the internet, there was no way to do this except if you had an agent or got published. And so I was one of those people who was sort of an early adopter of, you know, that blogging and, you know, sharing images of things on Flickr and things like that. And eventually I built a community of people, or I met a community of people who were doing similar things, and people started asking me that if they could buy my work. And I said, well, I'm not an artist. I'm just a person who draws and paints. And but then I started to think differently about it because I was drawing and painting all the time. I was getting better and better at it. And then I thought, well, maybe I could do this thing all the time because I do absolutely love it. So,
yeah. And so how long did that take from, you know, that sort of first tentative class to actually leaving your job? Because a lot of people think it's like an immediate thing because you're suddenly a genius.
And I always like to say there's no such thing as overnight success. Even people who have what we call overnight success usually have something that they are building upon before, even if it happened rather quickly. So I started drawing and painting in about 2001. By 2004, I was starting to post it on the internet. And by 2007, I left my job. And by 2011 or 12, I started to make a full-time living as an artist. So you'll notice that there was a few years there between leaving my job and making a full-time living as an artist. And I was eating a lot of ramen and, you know, living off of savings and things like that. So it took from, you know, between 2001 when I first picked up a paintbrush to 2010, 9 years. And I think I could have done it more quickly than that had I had schooling, had I had a guide to show me how to do it. So it's not like it necessarily has to take that long, but for me, that's kind of the way it worked.
And do you think that time also reflects your, I guess, apprenticeship as an artist? Because clearly over 10 years, you've become a better artist and therefore people are more likely to pay you for what you do.
Yes. And I think most people, you know, go to school for at least 4 years and study art. And that's sort of the beginning of their apprenticeship. But even if you do that, it's a really good idea over a period of years to just draw and paint every day or whatever your medium is. If you're a writer, to write every day. There's something about sort of getting your hands dirty and just doing the work every day, practicing, experimenting, trying things, putting it out into the world. And that period of time was my schooling in a way, or the continuation, you know, my schooling plus. Mm. And over that period of time, I certainly developed my voice as an artist. And developing your voice as an artist or even a writer is only possible if you do it often. And, you know, it just sort of doesn't magically happen. You have to really work at it.
Mm. And in the book, which is great, and, you know, it's about visual art, but I think it applies to any artist. And you, yes, you talk about how hard it is for people to say, I'm an artist. And it was so funny because it took me a long, long time to say I had an affirmation. I am creative. I am an author, for years before I actually was able to say it out loud or actually become that person. So how can people overcome that sort of difficulty in saying I'm an artist or I'm a creative?
Well, there's this thing that I came to learn existed, and it's called imposter syndrome. And so there's a name for that. And really, I think it's especially true for those of us who maybe started writing or painting or making things at an older age. It's not something that we necessarily studied in school or maybe when we were younger aspired to do, but discovered that we might want to do it. And so when we start doing it, we feel like an imposter. We feel like we don't really, if we have success at what we're doing, we don't really deserve it, that eventually someone's going to call us out for being a fake because we don't really belong to this club that we want to be part of. And so once I understood that there was a name for what I was experiencing, that made me feel better because that made me realize other people were going through it as well. And so every time I hear a story like yours, it's very affirming. And what I learned also is that even people who studied art in school or had very prestigious jobs in the creative field also often feel like imposters in the world. We feel like, you know, somebody else deserves it, but not us. And I think it's particularly true in creative fields. And so I started recognizing that all of this insecurity I was feeling about calling myself an artist or putting my work into the world, even though I was doing it, it caused me a lot of anxiety. Once I realized that there was a name for it, I started thinking about the fact that it was really unhealthy for me to be feeling that way. And I recognized it as something that was sort of self-defeating, and that if I was ever going to experience success, I had to really own my identity as an artist and stop feeling like I was sort of inferior to other artists. And just because I was self-taught or started later in life didn't mean that my work wasn't just as important or significant as anybody else's. So I just sort of one day declared, you know, like, I'm going to own this. I really had a breakthrough moment. And it wasn't like immediately I was confident. You know, it took a lot of practice and a lot of reminding myself when I did feel insecure that that my work was valid and that I was, you know. And it was interesting when Chronicle Books approached me to write Art Inc., which is the book that you referred to earlier, I said, what, me? I didn't, you know, like, who am I to talk about how to make a living as an artist? And they said, well, you're doing it. And I said, yes, but I didn't go to school. I'm not from the inside of the art world. I came from the outside. And they said, in fact, that's why you're the perfect person to write it, because the book is really for other people who are on the outside of it and want to be on the inside of it. So maybe you can demystify the art world or the illustration world for them. And so, again, I had this moment where I had to own that. And while I was writing the book, my editor said, you need to be more authoritative in your, you know, like, because I would say, well, this worked for me, but it might not work for you. And she said, no, what worked for you might also work for other people. So you need to just say, this is how I did, this is how I achieved this success, or here's some suggestions for how you can do it. So I learned to be more authoritative when I wrote the book. And now it's been several years even since I wrote the book. And I feel like every year that passes, I get a little bit more confident. But it really was just a lot of positive self-talk and maybe writing about it on my blog also, and understanding that this was a universal thing that people experienced, this not being able to claim their identity as a creative person.
I wonder also, I mean, every time you put out a different artwork, I wonder about the, I mean, you obviously got over that big sort of moment, but there's, for me anyway, I just put out a book this week as well. I know you have, and we'll come back to that. But
congratulations.
Thank you. I still have a fear of judgment. a fear of like people will read it and go, oh my goodness, she thinks those things. It was, you know, a fiction and there's people get killed and stuff. And, you know, do you still have that fear of judgment around your artwork or fear of criticism? That sort of, you know, still feeling that you are the person who is within that artwork?
Yes, absolutely. And I feel like, you know, I'll sometimes say to people, you have to separate, you know, and on a certain level, you have to separate yourself from your work, that when people don't like it or might criticize it, it's not that they don't like you. They just, it's maybe not their thing. So, but to a certain extent, it also is personal. Like, you know, as creative people, we are, everything we make and create, whether it's words or pictures, is an extension of us. So it's really hard not to take it personally. So it's easy for me to say that, but it's a really difficult thing to separate yourself from the criticism, you know, as a, you know, your worth as a human being from potentially any criticism that you may receive. So every time I post something or submit something to a client, if I have a job and I've been given an assignment, every time I send off that first piece of artwork that, you know, that I'm delivering, I have a tremendous amount of insecurity and anxiety that they're not going to like it, or that, you know, if I put it on Instagram, people, you know, especially if I'm trying something that I don't normally do and I'm experimenting, I do still have a lot of anxiety because it is very personal. It's something that I've worked really hard on and that I believe in. And that, I don't think that ever really goes away. I used to think that eventually, as a creative person or as an artist, I would arrive. And I put that in quotes, like that someday, and what I mean by arrive is that someday I would get to a place where criticism didn't bother me, where I felt very confident, where everything I put into the world felt easy, and where my life had a certain, my creative process at least, and my putting my work into the world had a certain flow. And I realize now, because I've been doing it for so long now, that's never going to happen. Like, it doesn't really change, and that's not actually a bad thing, that our vulnerability as creative people is actually part of what makes us make good work. Mm-hmm. And if we were, had no feelings about, a vulnerability, we wouldn't be able to be creative people. So, I watched this wonderful documentary about painter Gerhard Richter. It's called Gerhard Richter Paintings. And what I love about that film is, you know, he's this like preeminent painter in the world, and he paints both very abstractly and photorealistically. He's enormously talented, and he's, you know, at the apex of his career's work is in museums all over the world. And yet in this film, you see that he's super insecure. You know, he makes a painting and then he can't look at it for like 5 days because he thinks it's terrible. And he goes to art openings and, you know, he's obviously really awkward about talking to people because he's really shy. And I thought, okay, here's this guy who, you know, most artists would kill to be, and he's still hasn't arrived. You know, he's still in that, you know, has a lot of angst about his work and he's not super confident. And that actually, instead of making me feel worse, it made me feel better. It made me accept that, putting your work into the world is always going to be a little bit nerve-wracking and requires a lot of bravery. But the world wouldn't be what it is if people didn't do that. So I feel like I'm just, I don't know, contributing to something bigger than myself, I guess, when I put my work into the world. And I hope that other people feel that way too.
Yeah, I agree with you in terms of the writing as well. And I was also thinking about why we keep driving ourselves to do more. And I think it's, to me, it's kind of like when we finished a piece of work, when we say it's finished, there's always an edge of, that's not the end. That's not the best. Mm-hmm. That's not actually the best I can do, or it's the best I could do on that piece, but that's not, you know, there's always this need to do something further. Is that something you feel as well? Is that actually inherently what drives us to create more?
Yes, I think so. And, you know, every now and again, I would say every like 200 pieces of art that I make, there's one that I think is like pretty darn good. And I don't feel like I need to change it much, but that's a really, you know, that's what less than 1% of the time, most of the time I'm on a tight deadline and I've got to do the best I can do, and or I just feel like I'm maxed out on a particular piece and I know it's not perfect, but I don't quite know what to do to make it better, or I'm afraid if I try, I might mess it up more. You know, and that goes for my writing and my, you know, my painting and drawing. So, you know, sometimes I just say, this is good enough and I leave it be. But yeah, then I turn it in or I put it out into the world, because you have to do that. And I think a lot of people who don't actually are not very productive, creative, are maybe very smart and creative people inside, but aren't productive creative people, are usually people who are perfectionists and refuse to put anything into the world because it's not perfect and because they know it's not perfect. So I think that's what separates people who are productive creative people and people who are not, is just this willingness to put something into the world that they know is not perfect. And what is perfect, right? Anyway, so that's a whole existential conversation. But you know, I don't know. And I think that for me, you know, there's sort of like this period where I'm working really hard on something and I'm trying to get it to be as good as it can be. But then there's a period where I just have to let it go and move on. And you're right that after I've put that baby out into the world, I have to start creating another one, because and I think it's, you know, partly generated by this need to continue to improve or do something even more fantastic than we did before. But it's also partly because we have new ideas, or we're sort of bored with what we were doing before and we want to try something new. So fortunately, there's lots of different things that fuel us to keep going and putting things out into the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually another question I had for you, which is, you know, when you start being a productive creative like that, ideas are never the problem, as in you have generally so many ideas that there are lots of options as to what to create next. So apart from having a job from a client, how do you know what you're going to create next? How do you decide between all of those ideas?
Yeah. So a lot of what I do is client work, but a lot of what I do is actually very self-generated. Even the books that I create, I have a lot of artistic freedom from my publishers. And I do a lot of personal projects. So, you know, I make work on a regular basis that's just for me, or in my sketchbook, or for a personal project that I'm doing. And, you know, I come to the inspiration to create those things in a variety of ways. Sometimes it's through travel. I'll travel somewhere and my eyes will be opened up to a culture that I've never been part of, or, you know, some art and design that I've never experienced before that I find really inspirational. And I also am sort of a avid reader or looker at like visual history of cultures, and things like folk pattern and architecture, and even nature in particular parts of the world, and how those things influence things like graphic design and art and folk pattern in a particular culture. And so I'm sort of like a visual junkie, and I collect a lot of visual imagery, and sometimes in my travels, and then sometimes just by looking at books and at the internet. So I'm constantly collecting inspiration that way. You know, and I think in this day and age of the internet, we're in this sort of, especially for visual artists, we're sort of in this slippery place, because on the one hand, the internet is where we get our inspiration. But on the other hand, it's dangerous to get too much inspiration from the internet, because then your work becomes iterative or like just like everybody else's. So there's always this internal fight to, you know, open yourself up to being inspired by what you see, but also doing your own thing and making your work uniquely yours. And there are trends in art and design and illustration. And so, and it's great to be part of those trends and to be a leader in those areas. But at the same time, you want to make your work stand out as being different, or at least I do. So gathering visual inspiration on the internet where I do see a lot of things that inspire me, including the work of other artists. And I think it's hard not to do that. People ask me a lot about creative block, and I do have it sometimes, you know, periods when I'm not inspired and I don't know what I'm going to make yet next. But I know that I need to usually take a break. That means I'm pretty burned out. And that I need to sort of step back and not try. Sometimes just taking a break and not forcing yourself to make something or draw something or paint something is the way to go. I'm doing a project right now where I'm making a painting a week outside of my regular art practice, and posting it on the internet every Monday on my blog. And I usually make them on Saturday or Sunday. And there are Saturdays and Sundays when I don't really want to be in my studio. I just want to be outside, or I want to be at the movies, but I'm forcing myself to do this personal work, and I sit down and I'm like, ugh. But then once I get started, I get really into it. So sometimes it's just forcing yourself to push through that moment of angst, like, what am I going to make today? Or I don't really feel inspired. So it's complicated being a creative person.
Oh, yeah. I think everyone listening understands that. But I wondered, because, you know, you're primarily a visual artist, but you've also got a lot of books, lots of books on lots of different things. So I wondered, what are the similarities and differences between your visually creative work and your written creative work?
I feel like when I approach writing, and I've been writing on my blog, I used to write a lot more essays and long form pieces than I do now, because I'm so much busier as an artist, you know, with working with clients and whatnot. But I feel like when I sit down to write something, I have sometimes a much harder time getting started. So you have the blank page as a writer, and you have the blank canvas as an artist. And I would say, with paint, I can just, I know that I can layer over something. If I paint something and I don't like it, I can start over or paint over it. So it's not that hard for me to start. Often with writing, I will often stare at the blank page and not know. It's like you have to start, you have to type that first sentence. And that's often the hardest. So I find writing much harder, but I also don't do as much of it. And perhaps if I did more of it, it wouldn't feel as intimidating. Like, throwing paint on a canvas doesn't feel intimidating to me. And I bet you a lot of your writers listening will probably feel the opposite, because they are maybe more used to writing, but then when they do something, make something with their hands, it might feel harder because they're just afraid of messing it up, or they're not as comfortable with how to start. And, but I do find that once I get into writing, it just, and I'm writing about something that feels important to me, whether it's a story or I'm expressing an opinion about something, or I'm teaching somebody new knowledge, I enjoy it so much and it flows out of me. I can spend the entire day writing. So getting started at writing is harder for me, but once I get into it, I really do love it, and I wish I had more time for it.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting, because I was just thinking then, the thought of having a blank canvas, and I really like the color blue, and I'm like, well, what if I put a big blue smudge in the middle of the page on the canvas, and that's going to look really crap, and, you know, then what to do next? That kind of fear of it looking bad, but like you're saying, you then paint over it or whatever. I could give it to you, you could paint over it, but that... I was wondering about that as an editing process, because of course the writing process, you write your draft and then you probably edit it and then you give it to an editor. Is there an equivalent with your visual art? Do you have an external editor or are you the editor of visual art?
Well, in my personal work, I'm generally the editor, and I will often, especially if I'm having a show or doing something public with my work, I will often get the opinions of people I trust, typically our other artist friends, to come over and say, do you think this painting is done? Do you think I need to push it a little further? I work by myself in my studio now. I have a studio manager, but she's not an artist. But I used to work in a big studio with lots of other artists. And so I would just call them over and say, hey guys, do you mind giving me a little critique right now? But that was my choice and something that I invited. But with most of my illustration work, is very similar to working with an editor if you're publishing a book or a magazine article. So usually you start with a sketch so that you don't get too far down the road. If they're like, no, that's not what I was looking for, that's not going to work. So you turn in, like, I'm about to start a book cover for Simon & Schuster. And I'm going to get on the phone next week with the art director. She's going to say, this is what the book's about. I've sent you the manuscript. Maybe skim over it. Here are some ideas for what could be on the cover. And then I'll sketch about 6 different ideas very loosely in pencil. And I'll send those off. And then she will say, I really like this one. Mm. So why don't you push this one a little further? And here's how you might change it. Can you make it a little tighter? And then eventually the sketch gets approved. We call it a rough sketch. And then you're allowed to move on to final artwork. So at least the form of things is set. And then you add color and, you know, take it and make it look like it's going to go on the cover of a book. And even then, at the end of that process, it's also possible that they say, oh, those colors don't work, or you might have to step back or even start over. But in the world of illustration, we try to design the process so that you don't get to the end and then, you know, writing is really much easier to edit than artwork. I mean, because we have Photoshop now, where a lot of people do work digitally, it's much easier to change your artwork than it's ever been. But generally speaking, you know, it's hard. It's typically harder and more time consuming than editing writing. So we try to create a process where there are fewer chances that you're going to turn something in that is that people aren't, that your client isn't going to like, and you're going to have to start over by taking baby steps and checking in along the way, as opposed to just turning in the final thing and saying, do you like this? That rarely happens that way.
Yeah.
So that's the good news.
Well, no, that's really interesting. And of course, there you mentioned designing a book cover for a client, and you have a ton of different income streams. You're an entrepreneur as well as an artist, which is so brilliant. Can you just give us an overview of all the different things that you work on that make up your creative business?
Sure. And I'll probably forget at least one, because I do so many that every time somebody asks me this question afterwards, it's like, oh yeah, I forgot that one thing. So the main source of income for me now is books, a book illustration. And that includes making my own books. So I'm working on my 7th book now. My 6th book just came out this week. And then I'm in contract for 8 and 9 already, although I won't start those until later this year. So I also illustrate other people's books, either cover and interior, or just interiors, or just cover. So I do a lot of that. I do a little bit of editorial illustration and surface design illustration, like wallpaper, note cards, wrapping paper, stationery, that kind of thing. So illustration writ large, including my own books, other people's books, and my own books I also write or edit. So if other people are contributing things, then, you know, I edit and collect that information. Like right now I'm working on a book that has interviews and essays with other people in it, not just my writing. So that's a big chunk. I also teach mostly online classes. So I teach through a few different online forums, Creative Bug being the main one. And I teach just very easy art classes for people who aren't necessarily professional artists or don't even necessarily aspire to be, but want to have more creativity and learn how to draw, things like that. I do some public speaking. So I travel all over the world to give keynote addresses and talk at colleges and at creative conferences and blogging conferences. In fact, I'm coming to London in June to give the keynote address. Yeah, I haven't been to London or Great Britain since 1998, so I'm very excited.
Yeah, London's a lot better.
Everybody tells me it's changed so much.
Yeah.
I also have an Etsy shop. So that's my online shop that I've had for almost 10 years. And I sell prints and copies, signed copies of my book, things like that. I get, through a lot of these things like licensing my work, which I consider illustration, my books, the classes I teach, I make royalties or percentages of the sales of things. So a lot of my income is very unpredictable, because while I do get flat fees for things and advances that I can count on, a lot of my income is just depends on how well something has sold that has my artwork on it, or how well a class that I teach is doing out in the world. So But those are really the main things. I enjoy all of them a lot. And so I continue to do all of them. And, you know, there's some things along the way that I don't do as much of. Like, I'm having a show, I think, either this fall or next year in New York, like a fine art show, like selling original work, not reproductions of things and not books. And that's something I used to do a lot, but it's very time consuming. Mm. And to like make a big body of work, and then you don't really make as much money selling it. You work really hard, and then you can only sell your paintings for a certain amount of money, and then it just depends on somebody being willing to buy them. But I do love that. So I don't do it as often. Maybe once every 2 or 3 years, I'll have a big show. So that's also happening, but I don't consider it a major contributor to my income. It's just more something that I do. So there's a lot of things that I do that fall into that category. Like, they're not income generators, but I do them because I love to do them. And I do a lot of pro bono work for organizations and places that are not, you know, raising money for causes that I believe in as well.
Mm, which is great, because I think some people consider full-time artist as like, in the same way they consider full-time writer, you're just sitting in a room creating art over and over again, or sitting in a room writing. But it's a lot more than that, isn't it? And I wondered, you also said in your book that promoting your work can be just as creative and fulfilling as making the artwork, which a lot of people would go, no way, no, I want to just be a creative and create. So how do you balance that, running the business, the marketing, and the creative side of things?
Well, for many years, I did it all by myself. Now I have an employee who helps me with all of that. But my business has grown so much, and the opportunities that come my way are so, you know, they're so much more fruitful than they used to be. And that's what happens as your career grows, your opportunities grow, and your potential to do well financially grows. So I do have a lot of support, but my time is still very much divided between the sitting at the drawing table, as you say, which is, I think, what people envision that I do 8 hours a day. Mm. But, and some days I do get to do that 8 hours a day, but most of the time there's a lot of sitting at the computer, and working. Now my assistant answers a lot of my email, but I still have to field things for her. I still have to tell her how she should respond to things. So there's a lot of administrative stuff. And then marketing is really important. And part of the reason my career has become successful is because I got comfortable really early on with putting my work into the world. Again, even though it was intimidating and even though I knew it wasn't perfect. Mm. And I just didn't wait for it to be perfect or to feel comfortable. And I decided that I was going to embrace the process of promoting my work. So, you know, how can I make this fun for myself? And until Instagram came around, you know, I was mostly using my blog, and then sort of I would tweet about whatever I wrote about. But since my work is very visual, it's important for there to be a place where people can actually look at it. Mm. And I suppose for a writer, there needs to be a place for people to be able to read what you wrote and for you to talk about it. And so I use my blog in that way a lot to drive people to a place where they can see what I'm talking about or read the words that I've written. And I feel very, as a creative person, you know, every few years I'll change my blog design, and I'll get someone, I'll hire a graphic designer to help me rebrand and like make the space where people come to look at my work really inviting and interesting and easy to access all the information about me that they want to know. Like, where can they buy something? Where can they come hear me speak? Mm. What's my email if they want to ask me a question? And then on Instagram, which is the social media platform that I use the most, I use that to both to mostly share what's going on, what I'm making, what I'm working on. If I'm having an event coming up, I'll post a little image and a description. I post a tidbits from my personal life, you know, pictures of my cats or, if I travel, which I like to do, I'll take pictures of the place that I visit and the things that inspire me. But it is very much a feed that is dedicated to, you know, the visual look and feel of my business. And to me, that's just really fun. Mm. You know, I do understand that marketing is really not fun for everybody, but my advice is always like, figure out you know, think about how to make marketing fun for yourself and do it that way, because it will feel the most authentic and the least salesy and inauthentic if you really are doing the stuff you love and talking about the stuff you love and sharing the stuff that you love to share, as opposed to sharing things that you think you should be sharing or doing it in a way that you think you should be doing it.
Yeah. And that being authentic is kind of the only way to do this long term. But I wanted to ask you about that, because at the moment in the writing community, there's a lot of people who are saying, oh, they just can't sustain the pace of the indie writing world, which, you know, has kind of sped up the writing process.
Yes.
So what do you see separates the long term successful, productive creatives who are still happy and creating to those people who kind of burn out and fade away?
Well, I think what's really important, and one of the reasons I haven't burned out and faded away, is that I work really hard to take care of myself and make sure that I'm not working more than, I mean, occasionally I work 10-hour days, but most of the time I just work 8 hours a day. I try to not work at night. I try to keep regular daylight hours. And I know some people work better at night. And there's actually, I think, a stereotype that writers and artists only like to work at night, that
drunk.
We're sort of weirdos. Yeah. And that we're drunk. And you know, so if that works for you, fine. But, for me, I feel like I've tried to abandon this idea that I need to struggle, or that, being an artist should feel hard, and that, I'm, you know, that creative people are just as entitled to feel happy and to have an abundant life as anybody else. And so, you know, I take breaks, I take vacations, I make sure that I get regular massages, I get out and walk around and run and enjoy my life and my friends. And of course, there are periods where I do feel burned out and where I say, oh, why did I take that project? It's putting me over the edge. You know, if I had only not said yes to that project, I'd be fine. But inevitably, I get through the project and I learn from the experience. And I'm really trying to have more boundaries around the amount of work that I take. And once you're, you know, it's sort of like when, as creative people, we dream, when we start out, we dream of the day that our work is in demand. Like, that's where everyone wants to be, in the place where their email box is flooded with requests and they have choices and people want to work with them. But I'll tell you, the minute that that happens, it becomes even more stressful and overwhelming. And if you don't figure out a way to manage that and to detach yourself from that, because you have to say no a lot, because you can't say yes to every opportunity. If you don't figure out a way to manage that, you will burn out and you will shrivel up and feel angry and tired most of the time, instead of feeling joyful and grateful for what you have. And so I'm always trying to strike that balance. And I'm not saying it's easy, but I work really hard at, like, taking care of myself and my relationship and making time for my family, and making sure that if I do go through periods where I'm working all of the time, that it's followed by periods of time where I'm not working very much at all. And I'm getting better and better at that the older I get. But so that's sort of how I deal with that.
Yeah. And I think, as you say, it's a permanent rebalancing of what you're doing. So, like, I just come back from Austin, and then I did London Book Fair. And as an introvert, speaking is very difficult. So I was like, okay, I shouldn't have done back to back. That's like, and I know that I just overbooked myself. So it's kind of the lessons we learn. But all of that was fantastic. Now, I wanted to, we've only got a couple more minutes, and I wanted to ask you about your latest book, which is The Joy of Swimming, which is kind of an amazing title. Tell us about that book and why write a book on swimming.
Well, it happened in an interesting way. It wasn't an idea that I necessarily had packed away in the back of my brain for some time. Like, I always wanted to make a book about swimming. I published a book a few years ago called Whatever You Are, Be a Good One. And there is a fairly long essay in the beginning, but most of the book is hand-lettered, like, literary quotations that I love. And the book's done very well. And so it's sort of my bread and butter right now. It won't be forever, but... So anyway, when it started, it was obvious that it was doing well, and a lot of people were buying it. My editor said to me, two things. I'd like to make a sequel, which we did, which of course isn't doing as well because as writers, you know, second books never do as well as first books that have done well. Or maybe they do, but generally not. But then she said, if you could make a book about whatever you wanted, what would that be? And of course, at first I was like, I have no idea. And I started to think about all of the things that I could make a book about and all these ideas that I had. And swimming was definitely one of the things that I'm passionate about. I've been a lifelong swimmer. And there aren't a lot of illustrated books about swimming, but it was the one idea compared to some of the other ideas for books that I entertained that I felt like could translate well into an illustrated book. And so my editor thought it was a great idea. I wrote up a little, you know, proposal about what might go in it and started the process of brainstorming and organizing my ideas. My publishing house, the one that I work with most often, is called Chronicle Books. They loved the idea and I set to work on it. And so I started swimming when I was a little kid. I started swimming competitively when I was 8 years old. And I swam competitively through high school. I didn't swim in college, mostly because I didn't have the discipline required. You know, being a collegiate swimmer is like, a collegiate athlete of any kind is an incredibly intense experience. But when I was in my 20s, I started swimming again in Masters Swimming, which is like a worldwide organization for adult competitive or organized swimming. And I was a coach, and swimming really changed my life. It helped me get through a lot of very hard times in my 20s and early 30s. The swimming community in San Francisco, where I used to live, was a community that was really near and dear to my heart. And so when I started making the book, I was researching all kinds of things like the history of the swimming pool and the history of competitive swimming and the history of the bathing suit. like how was the bikini invented? And I got really nerdy about all of these different aspects of swimming that I knew nothing about. I had a real natural curiosity, which I think is important when you're making a book, especially a nonfiction book, that you actually are genuinely interested in the subject matter. And so the book is a kind of mishmash of, you know, profiles of swimmers who have some of them have pretty incredible stories, illustrations of that are very nostalgic in nature, some infographics that talk about swimming pool culture in different countries and, you know, the science of swimming and, you know, the history of the swimming pool, all those kinds of things, and lots of hand-lettered literary quotations, which I love. It's very colorful, and there's like, oh my gosh, like over 100, every page has an illustration on it, except for a couple of pages in my introduction, and the book is 144 pages, so it's very colorful, and I'm really excited to have it in the world. So.
Oh, that's brilliant. So where can people find The Joy of Swimming and Art, Inc. and your artwork and everything you have online?
Well, the first place to go is my website, which is lisacongdon.com. And on my website, there are links to my Etsy shop where, depending on stock, because I'm not Amazon, I can't have like 10,000 books in my garage. depending on stock, people can get signed copies of my books. Of course, Amazon, all of the Amazon affiliates out in the world, Amazon UK, all of the online venues like Barnes & Noble, et cetera, sell all of my books. So there are also, most of my books are in bookstores all over the world as well. So if somebody wants one and they can't find it online, I would just go to your local bookstore and ask. But you can also buy my artwork in my and some of my products that are out in the world through my website as well. So if you're looking for something in particular, you can just browse.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for your time, Lisa. That was great.
Thank you so much for having me, Joanna.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.